One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Randomly Generated History Club, where three non-historians pick a year at random and try to learn things about it. I'm Will, and I'm here with my two friends, Anna and Ant.
Welcome and hello.
I really liked how you increased the volume towards the end.
I know, you got so excited.
It's like you've been studying humans for a while and realize inflection changes sometimes. also, hi.
Human studies.
So this week in human studies, we're going to talk about 1664.
1664.
Which is the year that a certain beer was founded.
Yeah. Cronenberg. Cronenberg. That's really? Why we're all drinking them right
is
now.
It? Cronenberg
is
it, right now.
Oh, that is the number.
That's the numbers. 1664. Yeah.
When we do that, I didn't do that. Did anyone do this?
No, I thought about it and then I looked at it and it was like, yep, a brewery was founded. So.
Well, it may okay. or may not come up in my section.
Ooh. 1664 is also one of the only years in the Common Era to contain each Roman numeral exactly once.
Oh.
There are 8 years.
Oh, wow. Is that right?
That's a very good fact.
MDCLXIV.
Huh.
Presumably MDCLXVI also works.
I should have known that because I always do mental arithmetic in my head using Roman numerals.
I like to use Neolithic stone carvings.
It takes you forever to figure out the tip on a bill.
Okay, right. I want 3-word previews, please, from you all. First, Anna.
The nose knows.
The nose knows.
For me, Italian military supremacy.
Oh, psych.
Amazing. And my one is Big Red Storm.
Big Red Storm.
Big Red Storm.
Oh, I know what you're talking. Haven't you already talked about this? Well, we'll see, won't we?
Probably. Okay, this week I am going to talk about the enormous blob on Jupiter.
Wait, didn't you talk about this already?
I swear you've covered the big red dot before.
Have I made this up? Am I going mad?
I know.
Oh no, please continue. I want to learn about it again, maybe.
Have I?
I don't know.
Maybe you talked about it when you... I don't think it was ever a feature.
Oh my god, surely I'd remember.
Yeah, I think maybe you talked about it when you talked about the... Halley's Comet.
Right.
Or global cosmic Britain, maybe.
Cosmic Britain.
Okay, well that's a totally different blob.
Okay, sorry, okay. Sorry. Carry on.
Yeah. And anyway, I think even if I had, I don't think people would notice. I mean, no one listens that carefully, do they?
I mean, if we can't remember, then certainly none of the listeners
definitely not.
I think I would remember. So this particular blob was spotted in...
The sky!
Jupiter? The sky!
Oh.
So 1664 was the first time it was spotted. So what is the Great Red Spot, William? Thanks for asking. The Great Red Spot is a high-pressure region in the atmosphere of Jupiter.
Yep.
Which is a planet in the solar system, yes. Anna.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. And this podcast
takes the position that Jupiter
doesn't exist. I'm William. Don't believe in pressure. Pressure's for tars.
I think we're in a high pressure region right now, and Will has actually cracked.
Okay, so it's a high pressure region, and I think it in many ways similar to this whole undertaking that we are doing today. Uh-huh. You know, it is both persistent and lethal to humans, and it has these like enormously high winds. So it's absolutely outrageous. The whole thing is crazy. So the wind speeds are like 432. Kilometers an hour is the winds that have been clocked.
Are you talking about the podcast now or the Great Red Spot?
This is all the podcast.
Okay, good.
Yeah. So this is, which is like twice the speed. Oh, no, actually, maybe not quite.
Yeah, twice the speed of an average kite flying contest maximum threshold, I would say.
Exactly.
Us kiters wouldn't go out in that.
Okay, so this is going to be one of those unhinged episodes.
Well, I just like kiting, okay?
I know you do.
Oh, good Lord. And we have observed the Great Red Spot. Now, at this point, for the last 359 years continuously, which is completely bonkers, of course. But although history is when you dig into it, there's a bit of murkiness on this point, because it turns out that a storm has been seen on Jupiter continuously.
Was it
the same storm? There were like gaps in observations of several decades at one point.
It could have been just the good red spot at a certain point.
There's a really good like Clearasil ad that you can make for this, where you get a spaceship, you launch it up and it solves it, and then it's gone. And then...
Yeah, you could really torment a teenage girl by saying we've been able to see that great red spot for 385 years continuously.
Oh, that's so sad. And but it's also slightly mad to me that no one, I mean, there are these big gaps in people looking up at Jupiter, basically. Like literally no one like glanced up at Jupiter for like 40 years at different points in the past. But anyway, so it seems pretty likely it was the same one. It's a massive storm. Can you guess the size of the storm?
I think I do know it's something along the lines of it's like three Earths wide or something crazy.
Yeah, I'm going to say something that's so embarrassing because it's just going to be like orders of magnitude out. I'm going to say it's one Earth.
Yeah, so you are both in the right ballpark.
Okay.
So it turns out, interestingly, that it's reducing in size right now very quickly.
That's kind of terrifying.
Yeah, because when it gets to, when it eventually disappears, which we'll come to in a moment, the world will end.
the great red countdown clock.
Exactly. So it turns out that it's reducing in size quite rapidly. But so it was at its largest that we've observed it at about 100 years ago.
Okay.
And at that point, it was 40,000 kilometers in diameter, which is about three Earths size.
Wow.
It is now just a little bit over one Earth diameter. So it's,
wow. So we somehow both won.
It's on that Ozempic, isn't it?
The Great Red Spot is on Ozempic.
And at the present rate of reduction, it will become entirely circular. So it's like quite oval and broad now, but it's getting smaller and more circular. And it'll be entirely circular by 2040, which is not that long away, not that far away, really, in like, you know, cosmic terms.
Can you confirm that it's making a noise as it closes?
It does. No, I can confirm.
Yeah.
I can confirm that it does make that noise. Of course it makes that noise. Anyway, no one really knows how long the thing will like continue to exist. And no one really understands really very much about what the fluctuations are. But in 2019, so only 4 years ago, it began to sort of flake at its edges. I find this all quite fascinating, because when you think of space, you think of things being kind of consistent and only changing over millions of years.
Yeah. Mm.
And then you're looking at this enormous structure that's three times the size of Earth, and now only just over one times the size of Earth. And it's changing so fast, and it's like we're able to observe it on another planet. Anyway, it's just kind of fascinating.
It is really cool. And can you describe the flaking, though? What does that mean?
Yeah, so basically the edges are like, the edges are starting to kind of dissipate in a way that makes it look like there's less energy in it than there was. As in, like, the whole thing has less kind of centrifugal force, as it were. Centrifugal?
Centripetal?
Centripetal.
One or the other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's about the only thing I remember from physics is that it's almost never centrifugal.
Yeah, yeah. I just remember my science teacher twirling a bucket of water over his head in a circle and then realizing in order to slow down. And he did say, I should have used sand.
I
still think he's spinning to this day.
I think I would rather have a bucket of water dumped on my head than sand.
Yeah, maybe.
So
anyway, sorry.
The shrinking and the flaking together mean that a lot of astronomers these days and avid Jupiter watchers,
Jovianophiles, Jovophiles, maybe
Telejoves, believe that the spot may disappear within 20 years. At which point, of course, the Earth will end.
I thought of
life will
one.
End or no? Sorry,
Jehovah's Witnesses.
That is very different.
Yeah, I know, but like if you did a Jupiter witness.
Jehovah's Witnesses?
You're saying Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yeah, Jehovah's Witnesses.
Not Jehovah's.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll allow that.
Thanks.
Iterative wit. Okay, but there are other astronomers out there who think that maybe the size is linked to like the cloud coverage changing at right at like the top of, because we're seeing the top of the storm, right? But actually the underlying vortex is like not really changing very much. But really no one has much of a clue, it turns out. So the whole thing, it rotates. Can you guess whether it rotates clockwise or counterclockwise?
Ooh, I can guess.
Do that.
I think it's... So it spins the same direction as Earth, so that the actual planet spins the same direction. Nearly all the planets in the solar system do, for reasons of science. And therefore, that means because it's on the northern hemisphere, I think it goes clockwise.
I think the top of it goes clockwise and the bottom of it goes anti-clockwise.
That depends if you're looking at it from the top down or you're looking at it lying down up.
I think we're thinking about this with a really terrestrial, earthbound concept of physics. And I think that on Jupiter... There are no clocks, first of all. So how can I say clockwise or not?
I mean, what is a four-dimensional vortex?
That is a great question.
So it turns out it does rotate counterclockwise, which is not what either of you said. But and the period...
Very good preamble, though, okay. So I get some bonus points.
It's
right?
Actually kind of remarkable that in a question with only two answers, we both missed.
It's astonishing. So,
I was thinking of the Gulf Stream, so yeah.
Yeah, of course you were. And so what was... Okay, how long does it take to rotate? Here we go.
Wait, the storm? Or
so
the
a storm. So if I'm the big red spot, I'll put it this way. If I'm the big red spot and I'm rotating...
Yeah.
How long until I'm back up the way I am now?
400 miles an hour, three times the size of Earth. How? What's the circumference of the Earth? 18,000 miles or something like that?
Something like that. So it's probably pretty close.
I'm going to say it takes
24 hands?
14 days, Earth days.
The circumference of Earth is 40,000 kilometers.
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay, cool. We all know who's swallowed the spherical world pill.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Circumference.
Yeah, sure. Sorry. Yeah, yeah.
The straight line between ice wall to ice wall.
It's 40,000.
So what was your answer, Ant?
14 days.
I'm doubling that now to 28 days.
28
Why are you
days?
Doubling it?
I'm not doubling it. I'm keeping it 14 days.
Wait, so 14 Earth days.
14 Earth days.
Okay.
20 minutes.
I think it's 20 Earth minutes. Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, great.
It's fucking fast,
that's too
man.
Fast. That's too fast. I want to revise that. I think it's way higher, actually. I think it's probably 50 days.
It is 4.5 Earth days.
Holy crap. That
oh,
is
wow.
Fast.
I was closer.
That would absolutely cancel international kiting championships. That would be a danger.
Called off for inclement weather.
And no one really knows why it has this color it has. There are a few hypotheses supported by some experiments. So some people think that it's red because just clouds. And some people think that it has something to do with the irradiation of the ammonium hydrosulfide, which is so like when it interacts with the sun. Basically, no one really has much of a clue.
Some people think it's because Red is its favorite Taylor Swift album.
Is that a Taylor Swift album?
Oh, yeah.
And some people think it's because Red is its favorite Taylor Swift album.
Yeah.
Of course.
Jupiter's atmosphere, mainly helium and hydrogen. Do you know that?
Isn't like most everything in the solar system mainly helium and hydrogen?
Well, yeah, when you put it like that. Yeah, for sure.
So anyway, no one really knows. There you go. So there's some stuff about the big red spot first spotted in 1664.
By?
A man.
Galileo.
Probably not.
Is that true?
I don't think it was. But I do have some other Jupiter facts.
Oh, God.
Actually, that I do know. That did you know that Jupiter is the planet of luck, fortune, success, and generosity?
Mm.
And it's a kind and abundant force for good in the universe. It's an expansive, big-thinking, healthy, wealthy, and powerful, an engine of achievement and success. And that's all according to Cosmopolitan.com's guide to your Jupiter sign.
Nice.
There you go. Thank you very much.
No mention of spots.
Robert Hooke.
Robert Hooke in 1664, or potentially Cassini the following year.
Nice.
It's disputed.
Very cool. Good job, Jupiter. By Jove.
By Jove. And it's useful to know. And if you ever want to know how long you have left to live on Earth, just take a look up at Jupiter. And you can judge it by the size of the diminishing great red spot. 17 years from today is the answer.
Wow. I'll be dead.
Oh my God.
Because Will have killed me. This is the warning there.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
Okay, Italian military supremacy. We are, of course, talking about Hungary. But specifically, we're talking about the Battle of St. Gotthard, which happened in the year 1664, which is the year in question. Ding, ding, ding. Bonus points. I did it this time.
A good day to Gotthard.
A good day to Gotthard or die trying. Yeah. So it's about a clash of armies, a tale of intrigue and might. And I am going to weave for you a tapestry of human ambition, struggle, strife, shifting allegiances, and ultimately shaping Europe's destiny. So, come with me, weary traveller.
Oh boy.
Sit a while, while I regale you of tales of the mosaic of historical forces and personal tribulations that accumulate on the banks of the River Rab in Hungary.
Usually when he does such a big preamble... It ends in some sort of unhinged rant.
Yeah. No. Literally the next word out of his mouth will be Pope.
Shit. Okay. Big holy guy. No. So in the 17th century, as we all know, Europe was a veritable chessboard of empires vying for power. I mistyped that. It says cheeseboard.
To be fair, I think it was probably a cheeseboard too.
Cheeseboard of empires.
Yeah. I think that still applies. I mean, yeah. Like, you're saying there's like maybe eight different empires.
Yeah, yeah. And like a chutney that's like a sub empire.
Yeah, a couple of pickles and stuff. Yeah. Like as well, for sure. So the biggest pickle of all, though, was the Ottoman Empire, which was a behemoth that stretched across three continents at this stage. It was formed in modern-day Turkey centuries before, in about 1453, when it conquered Constantinople. I mean, it was forming for a while. But it was also locked in a centuries-old back-and-forth little palaver with its arch-nemesis, the Habsburgs.
Mm.
So the Habsburgs, interesting family outfit, I guess, rulers of a vast swath of Central Europe, including Austria, where the Battle of St. Gotthard was sort of the main antagonist were there. So this is a really pivotal point for the Habsburgs in general in Europe and the Ottoman Empire, as we shall see. So the Ottoman Empire, once invincible under Suleiman the Magnificent, was seeking to reassert its waning influence at the time by progressing ever westward to take on Vienna, I think, really, basically. So the masterminds of the resurgence were the Koprolis family, which is a dynasty of these savvy statesmen and generals. They actually provided six grand viziers to the Ottoman Empire, of which one of them now, Kapuli Fazil Ahmed Pasa, was the grand vizier at the time. And Fazil meaning wise, so you may call me Aunt Fazil, if you like.
Faisal?
Faisal, yeah. Wise.
Great.
Faisal. F-A-Z-I-L.
F-A-Z-I-L. Oh, no. I don't know what that means.
Well, you should have come to me as the wise man. Their goal was to solidify Ottoman presence in Hungary and push towards the heart of Europe, namely Vienna, for probably the cafe culture.
Sacher torts.
Yeah, that's very good. Opposing them, of course, were the Habsburgs with Emperor Leopold from the Habsburg family, the first, at the helm of the Holy Roman Empire, and who was anxious to defend Christendom's eastern frontier from these upstart Ottomans. Leopold's realm was riven with religious divides, though, and so it forced him to rely on this hodgepodge alliance between the Protestant German princes and even France, his traditional rival, for aid in this battle. Interesting point about the Habsburgs monarchy in general. It's kind of like an unofficial term to refer to Central European monarchy as a sort of a rule from about the 13th century. The lands shifted, but largely the same sort of familial groups stayed. And Vienna kind of was the de facto capital of this like sort of fluid empire in all but it was all but name as an empire.
On the cheese board, sorry to interrupt. Obviously, the French would be a brie or something.
Yeah, of course.
What are the Habsburgs?
An Austrian goat milk.
Yeah, some sort of like Alpine cheese
Or like a muesli.
Yeah,
muesli milk.
And then the Ottomans would be. Like a labneh or a feta or something.
Oh, yeah, true. And the Germans
they have,
be...
Do they have Greece?
Or like a kefir.
Yeah, kefir. Something fermented.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And the Germans are...
A badger.
A badger
cheese? Mm.
Just a badger.
Oh, just a badger, okay.
Fermented by badgers.
Yeah, great. I just wanted to make sure everybody has a good mental image of what's about to happen.
But important is to note is that they never really took on the title normally of like king or queen of an empire or emperor itself. And are often like archdukes and grand princes and that kind of stuff. So they're these like magnificent titles and stuff, which was effectively default. They were in charge of everything. However, Leopold was the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, which is, again, a sort of a loose definition of things, really more than anything else. Anyway, enter one spiffy Italian, Count Raimondo Monticello.
Okay.
Monticello.
Raimondo Monticello.
He had a stutter, and that's how it was written. He was a seasoned Italian-born commander.
With oregano seasoned?
It was so much oregano on this guy. I say oregano, but...
Yeah, anyway. I can't get behind that one, sorry.
But his military acumen was sharpened, actually, because he entered... service in the army as a foot soldier in the 30 Years' War, and he survived the entirety of the 30 Years' War, and he was soldiering for 30 years where he raised through the ranks, and he survived it, and eventually at this stage now of hard graft and experience, he was appointed the Habsburgs' war counselor and commanded the troops for the duration of this Austro-Turkish war in which this battle takes place.
It's pretty cool.
The odds were very much stacked against him. The Ottomans had a vast empire to draw troops from. They had interesting tactics, etc. But on the day in question, August the 1st, 1664, the two sides collided. Raimondo's troops, which was a coalition of Germans, Swedes, and French, unusually altogether, faced the Ottomans' formidable host, led by the Grand Vizier. And the battle raged, but despite being outnumbered, Raimondo's strategic genius prevailed, and he employed various tactics that enabled this. So three things in particular: positioning. He made use of terrain near the Rab River itself, which hindered the Ottoman Empire's advances, having the river either in front of him in places so that he could harry them with a crossing, or behind them for strategic defense that they couldn't be snuck up on. So he's very, very good at, like, I guess, river positioning.
It's important to know where.
Yeah, good river feng shui.
Wet gap crossing.
That's correct.
Yeah. He also used combined arms, which meant that he had a mix of infantry, cavalry, and artillery in smaller unit sizes, which was really effective to counter the Ottoman troops, who would then have larger blocks of mono type of troops. So they have a large block of infantry, and they'd have a large block of cavalry or something like that, and they couldn't adapt.
Never the twain shall meet.
Yeah, and they couldn't adapt very quickly to this like this multifaceted combined arms approach in smaller tactics. And they also used surprise and mobility. They also executed this heroic charge that's very famous for the area, where they took on the Ottoman forces, and they were so vastly outnumbered that it completely took, like, they're never going to charge us uphill at night, in a storm.
Yeah, 6 inches deep of snow.
The whole lot. It was very heroic. There's many songs sung about it.
Does it have
and
a
one
cool...
of them goes a little... No.
Does it have a cool name, though? Like Charge of the Light Brigade?
No, it just goes under the heading of Surprise and Mobility in what I've written.
Okay. Well, that needs a little bit of a rebrand,
I don't think it has a name. I think it's just like the charge of... the whole thing is the battle of whatever. And that's like the specific battle.
Cool.
So ultimately, though, Raimondo's massive experience won the day for them, and they threw back the Ottomans. And in the
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Aftermath, the Ottomans being defeated, there was a peace treaty that followed, and it was the Peace of Vasvar, which was actually curiously very lenient towards the Ottomans. For one thing, you know, the Habsburgs stopped pressing their military advantage and didn't continue going into their territories and pushing them back, which they absolutely could have done and just in a full route. And they sought out negotiations very quickly and to make this treaty. In this treaty, they actually gave up territory to the Ottomans. And they recognise Ottoman authority over certain other areas.
It's not a great treaty.
Yeah, it's really not. And all they got really from this was like minor economic concessions and like trading rights in the Ottoman Empire and stuff like that. So really, really small gains for a lot of bloodshed.
Hmm.
And this really led to a lot of people in Hungary to be very upset with Leopold, not least of which the people who were now part of the Ottoman Empire because of this treaty. And everyone was thinking, like, what was the point in all of this? And so the realms were divided in two, really. Some saw it as this massive diplomatic maneuver to establish a secure and lasting peace, the status quo, which actually did continue until the end of World War I, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And for him to refocus his efforts onto France rather than having two flanks that he needs to take care of. Another saw it as a massive waste of time, money, effort, and you're throwing away parts of the kingdom, etc. So... Which was it?
Call in and tell us.
Yeah. This did sow the seeds then, of course, for future unrest. There was conspiracies and uprisings with Hungary itself. You know, Leopold actually, you know, they're debating whether he was fit to be ruler, etc., all that kind of stuff. And thinking people just got thrown into the meat grinder for absolutely nothing, just political manoeuvring rather than actually like a sort of a...
So it's a metaphorical meat grinder?
metaphorical meat. Yeah, the German okay. meat grinder.
These were times of barbarism.
True. Raimondo, however, emerged as a hero. He became the grand general. And his name is held in high esteem in military lore. There's a modern naval ship in the Italian Navy named after him. On the other side, the Grand Vizier ambitions were thwarted. But bizarrely, actually... Even though it was a military defeat, his reputation was actually enhanced as a master strategist, and it was seen as this sort of like tactical withdrawal for better gains. So he actually, it kind of was a great diplomatic move because, yeah. You know, the Ottoman Empire wasn't embarrassed. They held the status quo, but they didn't encroach further westwards. So interesting kind of war is not the end state of this diplomatic maneuver, I guess. It's not just conquest through arms, which is an interesting sort of... new approach to warfare, really. Ultimately, the Battle of St. Gotthard was yet another pivotal point in the rise and fall of empires within Europe. You know, it wasn't a complete victory on either side, but it's just a, kind of an interesting case study. And the Ottomans continued to be powerful up until World War II, and the Habsburgs, you know, had rebellions, but they still managed to consolidate power, and in spite of this, were largely held onto it until their lands were split into nation-states post-World War I, on November 11th, 1918. So, Habsburgs very much are still a force for the world, and so were the Ottoman Empire for a very long time. There you go.
Cool.
That's it. That's history.
That's what it comes down to, is battles that in the grand scheme of things didn't really matter that much.
Well, it kind of did. It kind of like it established a new status quo that held for so long.
Yeah.
Even though it wasn't like the battle itself wasn't decisive, but
that's
the
true.
Diplomatic surroundings.
Because then Europe would spend most of the next three centuries just fighting each other.
Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
While the Ottomans laughed into their cultured, fermented
milks.
Milks.
Yeah. And coffee.
With their badger friends.
With their badger friends. With their badgers. Yeah, curiously quiet in that, the badgers. I today am talking about a man named Jean-Baptiste Poquelin, who we, of course, all know better by his stage name.
Ash Ketchum, gotta catch him.
Ash Ketchum. I'm talking about the very first Pokemon. Oh, you looked like you were going to guess who I'm talking about, Will.
I don't know what's happening.
Okay. How far back does that go?
About 9 or 10 months at this stage.
Okay, great. Yeah. Now I'm talking about Molière, the French playwright. Have you guys heard of him?
Vaguely familiar, rattling in my brain somewhere. But
yeah,
no.
Great. I mean, he's basically like France's Shakespeare.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So he
did like Steamboat Mickey.
He did Steamboat Mickey, which was like a weird bootleg version of Steamboat Willie.
Steamboat Willie. Okay. Why was he called Steamboat Willie? Was Mickey Mouse originally called Willie?
What?
No, I think Steamboat Willie is just the first Disney cartoon.
Ah,
so maybe he did turn into Mickey Mouse?
Was that guy? Maybe Willie was a different guy.
Yeah, maybe the steamboat was called Willie, and then Mickey Mouse was on the boat. Yeah. I'm going to pivot now and spend my entire segment talking about Steamboat Willie. No, Molière, the French Shakespeare, so much so that some people call French the language of Molière. I personally have been petitioning a few places around the world to see if anybody would consider renaming their language the language of Macaulay.
Mm-hmm.
Not like the big ones, because that's not going to happen, but there's got to be something that has like, you know, 500 speakers left or something. And I think my personal brand could really elevate it.
Okay, like Tagalog or something like that.
I think that has a few more than 500 speakers, probably in the tens, if not hundreds of millions.
Well, that's Tagalog. I'm talking about Tagalog.
Oh, Tagalog!
Which is the rare language spoken by duvet salesman.
Okay, yes, good. Duvet salesman, please write in. Anyway, so Molière, great guy, loved to play French, etc., etc. He was born into a very wealthy family in 1622, and in a great story, one of my favorites that I've uncovered recently, when he was born, a family maid saw him and exclaimed, "Le nez," which of course in French means the nose.
Oh, I thought it meant the year. Yeah, the nose.
Oh yeah, no, sorry, le nez. Because he had, I guess, an exceptionally large nose, especially for a baby. And then his family would call him Le Nez during his childhood, which I think is a great way to ensure that your child will become a comedian, because you've just eviscerated his self-esteem from a young age.
Poor kid.
Yeah, he got absolutely rinsed. Molière's...
My nickname... No, I'm not going to say
no.
that. Okay, I'm going to edit this out.
Okay.
My nickname was Le Penis.
Yeah. We all saw that coming.
I might not edit this
you
out.
You could have been like... Le belly button or something.
Oh, yeah.
Oh boy, I just can't move on from this. Molière's father purchased for himself a post in the court, which I didn't realize you could do, and he bought himself the position of valet or valet of the king's chamber, great, and keeper of carpets and upholstery.
Oh, there you go. He speaks Tagalog.
Definitely spoke fluent Tagalog.
Wait, wasn't the valet the person that did the shit buckets?
So I think that would be like his the king's personal valet, or as the English would say, valet.
We don't say valet.
Yeah, you do.
No, we don't.
Yeah, we've had this argument before.
Do you say valet?
A valet.
I rarely say either.
A valet is the guy who parks the cars. But have you ever watched Downton Abbey? Mr. Bates is the valet, your gentleman's gentleman.
I just throw my keys.
Yeah, into the chamber pot and see what happens. Anyway, so this guy, Molière's father, was in charge of keeping the carpets and upholstery, which was a pretty cushy job that that actually was unintentional. It required 1 month's work per year, but made him a lot of money.
Incredible.
So if anybody is looking for a keeper of carpets and upholstery, let me know. And then Molière would eventually inherit this position, which is great. And he enrolled in law school, so he's cruising for this lovely white collar life. But when he was 21, he was bitten by the acting bug.
Oh, yes. We've all been bitten
by that. We've all been bitten by that. He dropped out of law school and linked up with an actress he had met earlier to found a theater.
Mm.
And this was a big deal because at this time in France, actors were of a really low social class, as opposed to today when they rule everything. So this was a big break with his family and with what was expected of him. But the theater did really well.
Oh.
No, I'm kidding.
Oh.
It went bankrupt after only 2 years and he had to go to prison for 24 hours. And while in prison, he contracted tuberculosis.
Oh, God.
So why was he in prison?
Because the theater had accrued so many debts.
Oh, wow.
That he couldn't pay. And then when he was in prison, somehow, scholars dispute what happened, but the debts were paid either by Molière's father, which I think unlikely, or by an anonymous benefactor. Mm-hmm. But he did get TB, which is the worst.
Not great.
Not great.
Was there a badger in the cell?
Probably.
They notoriously carried
a German.
TB. There was a German. To our German listeners, I'm sorry. You're not exactly like badgers.
Yeah. Not all of you have TB. Anyway, he gets out of prison, pays his debts, and this is probably when he changes his name from whatever I said it was in the beginning, Jean-Baptiste Poquelin, to Molière. Molière. Mm-hmm. There's an E at the end of it, so I think it's Molière.
Yeah.
I don't speak very good French. Anyway, it was a way to stop casting so much shame on his family. And then this is where it starts to get weird, because even though acting is seen as this really low-class, almost taboo profession, he and his company gain the patronage of lots of really important people, including the elder brother of Louis XIV and Armand, the Prince of Conti, who is a very important nobleman. Armand, by the way, eventually contracts syphilis from a courtesan and turns toward religion, as you would probably do in that situation, and then becomes Molière's enemy. But regardless, Molière and his troupe really have the favor of the king. They play for the king himself at the Louvre, which at that time you could rent and use as a theater. And even though he prefers tragedies, he becomes really famous for his comedies and satires, which such names as The Imaginary Cuckold, The Blunderer, and The School for Wives.
The School for Wives?
Yeah.
Amazing.
And in 1661, a man named Nicolas Fouquet gave a series of parties in honor of Louis XIV and staged several of Molière's comedies during the parties. But then the first minister of state arrested Fouquet for wasting public money.
Yes.
And he was given a life sentence.
Yes. So this is actually, I do know about this. So this guy, so his house he had built, he was trying to ingratiate himself with the king. But he would often upstage the king.
Mm.
And so he built his house and he had the finest architect in the land. The Palace of Versailles would go on then to be designed by the same architect that built his house. And
huh.
He had this grand massive party that was supposed to be like in honor of the king. But because he was the epicenter of it, he then like the king basically sort of snubbed him. All of society frowned upon him. And then he was subsequently arrested for wasting public funds, which he was doing completely in cahoots with the king.
Yeah, to honor the king. Yeah.
The king knew this, that he's like, yeah, you take some, I take some, it's all good. We're all ripping everyone off. But I'm going to turn on you because you've upstaged me, because the king was just like completely, you know, insecure, actually.
I know they have this wild understanding of the theater. They really just can't decide if they're totally ashamed of it or if they really want to celebrate it. But yeah, at this guy, at Nicolas Fouquet's party, they did some Molière.
That house that was built by the same architect as Palace of Versailles is actually for sale at the moment.
Ooh.
I think. And
should
so
we
you
buy
can
it?
Actually, you can actually see it. I think it's something along the lines of like £400 million or something like that. It's a
oh,
ridiculous
that's fine.
Price.
That's how much we get from the Patreon every month.
I think it's like, if not the most expensive, like one of the most expensive houses in the world. And it comes with like, it's completely opulent inside. It's amazing. So if you're like me and like spending time on Rightmove or Zillow or whatever, just creeping through people's houses, this is a specifically good one to go
okay,
through.
We'll put the link on the on Twitter or something. Anyway, Molière's plays keep getting sharper and sharper. He's really skewering the upper class, so he starts taking some heat for that. But the king still loves him, so much so that he agrees to be the godfather of Molière's son. And I think it's because, despite this like really intense satire of all the upper classes. He never actually attacks the monarchy, which is very shrewd. In 1664, the year in question, he writes his most famous play, which is called...
Gone with the Wind.
Close.
Two. The Breezening. Well,
yep, got it. Do you know what it's called?
Romeo and Juliet. Romeo and Juliet.
Yep, correct. You guys Earl both got it, actually. Francesca. Its third name, what it's more popularly known as, is Tartuffe. And it is a comedy that lampoons religious hypocrisy and gullibility. It's this about this guy named Tartuffe who's welcomed into the home of a wealthy man and is presenting this very pious and faithful exterior, but inside is actually very deceitful. And he's actually manipulating the wealthy man and trying to take over his household, steal his daughters, et cetera, et cetera.
Are we all trying to do that?
I know. It's the autobiography of Ant.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
That's my self-help book. Teaching toxic masculinity.
Tartuffe or toxic masculinity. Louis XIV loved it, but under pressure from the Archbishop of Paris, he actually had to suppress it because it presented such a strong critique of the religious establishment. Hmm. But the king continued to privately support Molière, probably saving him from excommunication, which is nice. And the play would be staged for private parties of aristocrats. And eventually, in 1669, Molière premiered an edited version of it, which was allowed to be performed. And that is still the version that is performed all the time to this day.
Can't move. Productions of this.
There's actually somebody performing it in your living room right now.
Every single high school across the country.
Tartuffe to the ears.
All the time I have to make a papier-mâché Pope's outfit for, you know, my cousins or whatever.
Now, what part of the Pope outfit has papier-mâché?
The hat? The indomitable spirit of the Catholic Church.
Okay, great. Sadly, Molière didn't live much longer after this. In 1673, he was starring in his own play, which was called The Imaginary Invalid, which is kind of ironic because he was a real invalid. And he had this huge coughing fit and started hemorrhaging blood on stage, which makes for a really fun night at the theater.
Daniel Day-Lewis levels of commitment. That really is.
Yeah, he was really method. Really, really method actor. He insisted on completing the performance, which I think is something Daniel Day-Lewis would do.
Absolutely, respect that.
And then as soon as he got home, he collapsed again and died soon after. And to this day, there's a superstition in the theater that green brings bad luck to actors because that's what color he was wearing when he died.
Not like licking dead badgers that gave him the consumption or whatever. Just the...
Yeah, but green, mostly the green, not the licking of badgers.
What was consumption?
TB.
Oh, it was TB. Okay, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And under French law at the time, actors couldn't be buried in sacred ground, which I think is wild.
Wow.
But Molière's widow actually asked the king to make an exception, and Louis XIV said, okay, he can be buried in the part of the cemetery reserved for unbaptized infants.
Ah, yes.
So, you know, a good compromise there.
That's good.
What was so wrong with acting?
This is what I'm saying. They can't decide if they love them or if they're just absolutely reviled.
That's so crazy to
me. I know.
I think it's just they're generally seen as kind of like lowbrow. They'd be in the bars associating with like you know, it's like prostitutes and actors.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and mimes or whatever. Like, you know, it's a lowbrow stuff.
Mimes, I get. Mimes shouldn't be buried in sacred ground, and I'm willing to die on this hill.
And I think it's also probably something to do with the fact that you're actually effectively just lying, right? You know, you are not, you know.
Yeah.
There's no wall there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it, I think they were doing, right, they were satirizing stuff, they were bawdy, they were not taking things seriously.
Naughty
it does
monkeys.
Seem really harsh not to let them be buried in a cemetery. Yeah. But I do think eventually they walked that one back. I can't confirm, but...
Any dead actors?
Any dead actors who are listening, please let us know where your final resting place is, whether or not it has been consecrated. Anyway, that is Molière and Tartuffe.
Love it.
And the end of the podcast.
Podcast end.
Podcast end.
Okay, here we go. Outro. Hello.
Nope.
Nope. We did that part already.
Goodbye.
Thanks for joining us.
There it is. We're keeping all of this.
We're not ending this out. we want the world to see you
People
suffer.
People need to know how bad you are at reading a script.
You're like incapable of it.
He's rubbing his eyes like a tired little baby.
Okay, so we're watching him. Will is going to do the outro.
Thanks for joining us. That's everything you'd ever need to know about the year 1664. So, Will, can you please?
Before we do this, though, before we go on with the script, I would like to go off script for a second.
Oh, God.
To say a hearty thank you to our listeners out there. I've been actually graced by meeting a couple of listeners IRL recently.
Wow.
And they have been full of nothing but praise.
Despite the restraining order listeners have against us.
And it was very good. And I wanted to extend that to my two co-hosts, Anne and Will, for congratulations to you. I will still bask in the glory on your behalf anytime.
Oh, sure.
Thank you very much.
And if you think that someone else would enjoy this, then you should definitely tell your friends. And who knows? Maybe you can...
Be buried in sacred ground.
Yes, I really struggled at the end of that sentence there.
We can pull those strings.
Anyway, that leaves us to say, Will, we need to get the next random year, please. Can you boot up the random number generator?
I absolutely can. And as a reminder, we've set the random number generator to choose a year between the years 1000 BCE and 2000 CE.
Before the Christ era and 2000 in the Christ era.
that's fine. And the year is one fat lady and two zeros to 800.
Worst bingo ever.
what's a zero in bingo?
I don't think you can get a zero in bingo, can you?
That's probably why there's no bingo.
Because you already have the numbers that it draws, and it's like, this is the zeroth number.
The year's 800, to clarify, the year's 800.
Okay, the year
800.
As they say, one fat lady and two zeros. I've been looking forward to this year for that exact reason. 800, okay, great. You know, we've been coasting. I think these last few years, we've had a lot of relatively modern ones with a bunch of stuff. Back to the trenches we go.
Back into the archives.
Fighting.
Dredge up.
I now have a British Library reader's card.
Oh, nice.
Which you could only get recently. Like, you used to have to do like an interview to get it. Mm-hmm. To be like, why are you worthy of books?
Yeah.
And now you don't need to do that. So I can go there and touch all the books I want.
Should we go and...
Have you been to the reading room? It's really great.
There's many. It's great.
Yeah,
there's
yeah,
loads.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
My British Library reader's room pass is, I would say, the worst picture of me ever taken. And I will show it to you after we stop recording.
Maybe we can put that on the Patreon.
Maybe put it on the Instagram.
We should go and look up something that tells us how to build a time machine so we can go back to the year 800 to do the research first.
Or make an event worthy of remembering.
Yes.
Because I'm assuming there's not much.
What if we succeeded in that, got in the time machine, went to the year 800, and the first thing we said was, two fat ladies and two zeros. And then we all got the plague, I guess. No, a little early for the plague.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, very early for the plague.
Okay. Find out next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Toodle-pip.